Good morning. We'll go ahead and get started. Welcome to everyone. Welcome to Disability Grand Rounds. And we think this is the fifth year, according to the count that Jan did, the beginning of the fifth year of these joint Grand Rounds. And Robin says, yes, that's correct. So we're happy that you're here with us. And these rounds are co-sponsored by the Kennedy Center and by the Vanderbilt Center for Child Development. And as part of this, I need to let you know, as the slide says behind us, that this has been approved for an hour of continuing medical education. If you need that, please be sure and sign the sheet that's strategically placed by the food at the back of the room. And I've been asked to remind you to please write legibly, and please do put the last four digits of your social security number, or it'll be difficult to track you down and to give you the appropriate credit. And also, as part of the accreditation for the CME, I also have to let you know that our speaker does have financial relationships with two companies, Eli Lilly and Cephalon, related to research grants for medication studies. So that taken care of, I'll move on to the to introduce our speaker. And by the way, I'm Lisa Kraft, and Craig Kennedy and I will be alternating introducing our speakers for this year. So today we're pleased to have Dr. Steve Couch talking with us. And Dr. Couch received his medical training at Baylor University in Houston, Texas, did his fellowship in child development and disabilities at Kennedy Krieger at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And he's currently assistant professor of pediatrics at Vanderbilt Center for Child Development, where he provides clinical evaluations for children with disabilities, including attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. He also directs the pediatric rehabilitation services at Vanderbilt Stallworth Rehab Hospital. And Steve has been involved in several research projects involving medication trials for children with ADHD, and today is going to be talking with us about ADHD and medications and some other related issues. So welcome, Dr. Couch.
Thank you, Lisa. I thought I would pick something not very controversial to start with, like ADHD, which everybody wonders what's going on, and so do I. So part of what's happened, several years ago, a learned professor I respect made the statement that where there's controversy, there must be less supporting data. And the more controversy, the less data to support it. So ADHD is still a controversial area. I thought I would try to find out what data there is to support some of it. I unfortunately got lost into the data, but I will, because it's voluminous and confusing. But today I was going to try to extract some things that I learned from the literature and try to provide some data that we know. All right, and I thought I would do this as answering a series of questions. Well, incompletely answering a series of questions, which are like, what is ADHD? What are some of the neurologic correlates? What is the effect of medication? And what do we know of long-term effects of medication? So ADHD itself, a developmentally inappropriate hyperactivity, impulsivity, and or inattention, causing a functional problem. Now we have a diagnostic criteria, yes. And it doesn't imply what the etiology or what the associated features with it. So here's some characters of behavior problems. Tigger is very hyperactive. Pooh is fairly inattentive, as well as not thinking so clearly, and Piglet has anxiety. Okay, so at the current way, we had divided ADHD into three types, primarily inattentive, hyperactive, impulsive, and a combined type. There's been a lot of validation studies that basically confirm or stick to this pattern. So this holds up under a lot of study. So the etiology is still unknown. So as best we can tell, it's a heterogeneous condition. There are a lot of causes, many of them still unknown, that come to a common pathway or a common endpoint. So we think of it as a complex interaction of the neurobiology and the environment. Therefore, each individual may actually have a relatively unique condition, although some of them are similar. There are strong genetic associations seen in family and twin studies. There's environmental influences that are also strong, like the culture and behavior of the family, the culture of social groups and experiences and education, which we expect modulate the genetic predisposition. there is no threshold effect noted, so therefore this is a spectrum disorder. And we know a lot of spectrum disorders. So the occurrence, well, that depends on how you're calling it, but where your threshold is. But the occurrence for most people is suggested around 6 to 12% of school-age children in the United States. Now that raises an interesting point about is this abnormal? So if you would say that two standard deviations, which is about 2.5%, which is our traditional definition for abnormal, if that's abnormal, then half of the then the majority of the diagnosed people will be less than two standard deviations from the mean. And therefore, you might characterize it as a variant of typical behavior, as opposed to calling it a definitive abnormality. Nonetheless, it has functional problems. Now, William Carey has written a lot on temperament, and temperament is influencing behavior. And he says, as do many of other people, that that less adaptable and less persistent temperament characteristics cause what looks like attention problems and a conflict with the environment. And therefore, the dysfunction is more the interaction between the individual and his environment, not the specifically a disorder of the individual. And then ADHD is cross-cultural. Similar rates of occurrence have been reported, not identical, but similar, from Europe, Asia, Africa, South America, and Australia, New Zealand. So some of the natural history of ADHD. There's no truly untreated sample, because education is an important part of treatment. So in the US, everybody's got some treatment. That makes the studies more difficult. Hyperactivity by itself seems to naturally modulate with adolescence, although restlessness may continue. And 10 to 50% of children with ADHD seem to still have trouble in adulthood. And again, depends on how they ask and how much of a problem it is. But the problems adults report are difficulty with inattention and executive function, restlessness, impulsive behavior, and poor self-concept. Okay, so what are some of the neurologic correlates of ADHD? Yes, sir?
You didn't mention gender.
I didn't. No.
Can you?
I can, yeah. There's a male bias, yes. And most of the studies of children suggest about 3 to 1 male to female predominance. In adulthood, they talk about 1.5 to 1. And so people have wondered if part of what happens in childhood is partly hyperactive, overactive behavior seems to be more common to males, and that also is more easily detected rather than just inattention. And so part of the one thought is that there is an over-detection of males.
What about handedness? Serious?
No, I know. I'm thinking because that's deep in my memory, and I don't know if I can drag that up. There has been discussions about left-handed people having more problems with attention. And the discussion has been about whether their hemispheric dominance is messed up. Yeah. But I don't know the rate in left-handed people versus right-handed people. Are you left-handed?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I have major hemisphere confusion.
Okay, so some of the neuroanatomy. Most of the studies on neuroanatomy were small. There was a large MRI study from NIMH by Castellanos of, 152. That's the largest study for this. And generally, what the anatomy structures studies have implicated frontal striatal circuitry. Generally, and his MRI study shows a smaller prefrontal cortex, mostly dorsolateral, which has been associated in a number of studies with decreased organization and attention, and also discussions of smaller caudate and pallidum size associated with less response inhibition. Some identification of the rostral body of the corpus callosum associated with impulsivity, and then smaller cerebellovermis. All these have a moderate effect. The size difference is about around 10%. And these are generally all areas that are known to use dopamine as a transmitter. And so the discussion has continued to center around dopamine and dopamine transmission as central to ADHD. Some studies of blood flow show the same areas, lower activation of the striatum was seen during response inhibition. In particular, ADHD subjects failed to activate the anterior cingulate cortex, and depending on who studied, the left or the right ventricular lateral prefrontal cortex during response inhibition. And then use of stimulant medication increases the perfusion of the striatum close to the control group.
Steve, did you say that most of these imaging studies were done in post-pubertal individuals like teenagers or adults?
I didn't say that, but that's true. That's true. Partly because it's been hard to get hyperactive six-year-olds to hold still.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So most of the information is from post-pubertal individuals?
Well, Castellano's study starts, I think, at age 8 and goes up. And one of the interesting things of the anatomy, MRI anatomy structures, is that which structures are smaller relative to control change based on age. And so one of the conclusions of the studies is that we need more information on how things change with age. So a sample SPECT scan showing decreased perfusion of the left frontal lateral cortex. I need some color pictures, sorry. The common theme of brain injury, so I just said that, but some of the changes seen at a younger age may disappear or reverse at a later age. One of the discussions is about the sample. Most of the people that volunteer for subjects have been treated with medication, and does that change their outcome? The studies that have used subjects never treated with medication have found the same outcome, so it doesn't. So it seems that once they stopped their medication, they returned to nearly the same state as those who had never taken medication. And that they said we need more longitudinal studies. The genetics of ADHD, I move into this with hesitancy because of all the geneticists around here, but the twin studies have showed very high heritability, about 0.76, so much of the discussion about what genes are in that. There are a lot of genes implicated. The most common ones have been the dopamine receptor 4 and 5, the dopamine transport. The serotonin transport comes up in protein, comes up in studies. Dopamine beta hydroxylase, the serotonin receptor B, and the SNAP25. Generally, these people talk about it being low-power studies with modest odds ratios. And there's a study that just came out in molecular psychiatry from a British or a European group. And they have 776 subjects with SIBs, matched SIBs, and parents DNA, and they suggest they found basically the same genes implicated, and said that they thought maybe an N of 2,000 would generate an adequate power. Yes.
What is the odds ratio, the average odds ratio of these studies for particular genes? Do you happen to know, or about proportional variance? Look for.
I don't remember. Yeah, it's small. It's small. Yeah. A little bit, but it's small. I mean, I think they talk about LOD scores of 2.5 to 3 for the high ones. Does that help?
For the highest ones?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, modifying a quote from Michelle Mazie in Dr. Blakely's lab, but it says that while a common variant within a gene is unlikely to play a major role in ADHD, the contribution of genes to risk may be most evident in phenotypic subgroups, which is, in one way, to say that there's no specific gene that's going to seem to create, it's going to explain a large proportion of ADHD. But it may help us a lot in knowing more about it. Okay, on to what does medicine do? Well, first of all, I want to tell you something about what medicines we have approved. So methylphenidate, which is said to be dopamine and norepinephrine agonist, was introduced in 1957. So not a new medicine. Brand names are on there. Amphetamine, which was introduced 1917 and then changed to prescription only in 1955, again, not a new drug, has been around a long time. Pemolin, which is Sylert, has been removed from the market because of liver toxicity, is no longer available. And then atomoxetine, the only new drug that's been approved, was approved in 2002, and that's single brand name, Strattera. So some of the non-approved medicines have been used nonetheless. The tricyclic antidepressants were used historically. The use has dropped off for ADHD, partly because of there have been scattered reports of cardiac arrest. Wellbutrin has not been as well studied. They're now the selected norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, which have been used and not as well studied. Provigil, modafinil, and interesting because this also reflects some of the pharmaceutical influence now in the ADHD. Modafinil is approved for sleep disorders. It stimulates the cortex through the hypothalamus. Exactly how it works is still unknown. Side effects are occasional nausea and vomiting and insomnia, but relatively mild. The company decided to see if they could get it approved for ADHD. They went through all the trials. We were one of the study centers. And the FDA gave them a non-approval letter due to one person who got a rash. And the company is elected to just stop exploring it. So while their data says, yes, it works for ADHD, it's a little milder than the stimulants, it has few side effects, the company's not going to ask for approval for ADHD and stop exploring that. So then clonidine, guanfacine, I think I left the letter out, has been used a lot. It's not been well studied, but we use a lot. Like once again, there was a study trying to license a long-acting version of guanfacine for ADHD, and they're running into efficacy problems, and it may, it's still ongoing, but it may never come out. And we participate in that too. Another one of my conflicts. So the long-acting methylphenidate preparations, which is the what happened was the use of methylphenidate began skyrocketing through the 80s into the 90s. And so the drug companies, as a response, identified this as a market and started developing long-acting preparations. Then the presence of long-acting preparations, which got it out of school, then may have contributed some to even more use of the medication. And the long-acting preparations now are Concerta, which is an osmotic delivery system. And they formulated it as 22% immediate release, 78% delayed release, and the idea was to maintain a continual blood level. And it comes in odd sizes because their exploration data suggested that these are the sizes that were the most effective. Metadate CD did 30% immediate release and 70% delayed release, and again, they were thinking that seemed to maintain more steady blood levels. The Ritalin LA is 50% immediate and 50% delayed. These are coated beads. And the idea of the delayed, they were duplicating what taking a short-acting pill twice a day looks like, and that's the way their curves go. Focalin XR is the dextro half of methylphenidate. And we have known for a long time that the D half has most of the activity. The L half is left active, and so the companies isolate the D half. There's some evidence that that their preparation lasts longer than the Ritalin LA, which is from the same company. You know, why it should be different puzzles me, because if we only thought the D half was doing the activity anyway, then isolating it should make no difference. And then Daytrana was just approved 3 months ago, but it's a patch transdermal system. And the idea is that apply it for 9 hours a day and give about 12 hours of activity. But it has to be removed every day, because if you don't remove it, you develop tachyphylaxis in about 2 days and the medicine no longer works. And then another thing is amphetamine has now become Adderall XR. Adderall XR is the number 5 prescribed drug in the U.S. now, behind just in case you're interested since I hear that comment. It's hydrocodone, oxycodone, Xanax, Lexapro, and then Adderall. So two pain medicines, two psychoactive medicines, and Adderall, the top five drugs in America. And then what we haven't forgotten is the dexedrine SR, sustained release, which is now generic, so therefore the cheapest long-acting. It comes in smaller doses. And then atomoxetine, which comes in these funny sizes from Lilly. The problem with atomoxetine is it's naturally long-active, and it tastes really bad. And so if you cannot swallow the capsule, it's very difficult to get people to take it. Adderall XR, the company, Shire makes Adderall XR, and they have another product in development, which doesn't have a name yet. It's under NRP-104. And it's a group of protein chemists stuck a amino acid in the active site of amphetamine, so it makes it an inactive prodrug. It is cleaved by the intestinal brush border. It is naturally long-acting, and therefore has been submitted to the FDA for approval as a non-controlled amphetamine, which would mean you could get multiple refills and phone-ins. And it's likely to be approved next spring. And it will be interesting to see, from a market standpoint, what happens with the prescribing of medicine when that's approved. From Shire, in the Adderall people, a receptor, pictures, the cartoon suggesting that their Adderall works at both vesicle release and on the dopamine transport protein. So, what do we know? Well, what I can find is incomplete, but I'll tell you that methylphenidate effect has been known to be blocked by reserpine, which depletes the vesicle population, implying that part of the action is released from the vesicles. We know it has affinity for DAT protein, the dopamine transport protein, and the D isomer is more active than the L isomer. The amphetamine effect is blocked by methyltyrosine, which blocks synthesis, but not reserpine, suggesting it's less effect on the vesicle, although we know there's some affinity also for DAT protein. And again, the D isomer is more active than the L, but the L isomer is more active peripherally, so you get more cardiac stimulation. And then atomoxetine, a selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, is an antagonist specifically to the norepinephrine transport protein. So some of the effects of medicine, the desired effects that are seen include reduced fidgeting and squirming, reduced aggression, reduced impulsive and overactive behavior. And then cognitive studies, of which there are many, talk about improved attention, accuracy, and retention time, and sequence completion, and also some benefit effects on memory. And the thought is that it's more memory recall, not so much the learning, but being able to drag information out of your memory. Now we have... And then I should say caffeine is also stimulating. How many people took their caffeine dose this morning to help improve their attention, their memory, their seat work? Some of the time course. Now this is from a study that compared Metadate and Concerta against placebo. This is from Lab School Network. And there's a network of laboratory schools at universities. The SCAMP is a... measure that was, SCAMP is an acronym of the five people who developed it, S. S. Swanson. And they compared these two medicines and placebo, and the Metadate's the triangle, Concerta is a circle, and placebo is a square. And what they saw, deportment is behavior and attention, and PERMP is a math test and a measure of how many questions correct you could get in 10 minutes. So as we expected, during the course of a 7.5-hour day, the attention of the control group deteriorated and their behavior deteriorated. And those treated with medication at the 1.5-hour point, which is the first setting, had much improved behavior, much improved attention, much better answering scores. What they saw was the Metadate's scores were lower than Concerta, but the Concerta stayed, which is longer acting, stayed better out to, this is a parent rating in the evening. One of the interesting things is here, the control group starts at a different point than the medication group. And these And there's Swanson tries to explain why this is. And this must be a medication effect. And these children had repeated medication in 4 weeks or before they took this before they were entered into this. And the thought then is that these children here who were taking medication the night before, we know that the medication may have a rebound effect, and so that they seem to be worse in the morning than those who were on placebo that week. And I think that's all the point I was going to get out of that. Some of the side effects of medicine. Well, the common ones we know about: stomach ache, loss of appetite, and even anorexia. Insomnia, sometimes it's difficult to fall asleep. Headache. And emotional flatness. Emotional flatness does not begin to describe what parents talk as the zombie look. And we tend to associate that with what too much medicine does. But everybody has their own sensitivity, and there are children who will get the zombie look on the smallest possible dose. Why there's such variation in medication response is unknown, and it comes back to, we suspect it has to do with genetic susceptibilities, which we don't know yet. Then other effects have been reported, including increased tics, motor tics, lowered seizure threshold, irritability with some, especially with amphetamine, agitation, especially children with bipolar disorder treated. Who are treated then with stimulants may be more prone to developing agitation. Growth delay has been argued for a long time, and there is conflicting data on whether heights delay actually happens. The slide that had the long-acting preparations on it, all those licensing studies looked at growth over the course of 2 to 3 years. And what they found was that the children treated with medicine averaged 1 centimeter shorter than those who were not treated with medicine. So the thought was that there may be a mild growth delay, but it's difficult to show and it's probably not significant.
Steve, did these side effects cluster? That is, do you see children who So for example, you see some children who have insomnia and headache but really don't have any appetite issues or other GI issues, where you might see some kids who have GI issues, maybe emotional flatness is common across the population. Just how variant is
I don't know if I have a good answer for that. I don't recall reading anything that talked about a clustering like that. I don't know. I don't think so.
I was just thinking about it from a gym.
Yeah.
Anyone ever studied the incidence of Parkinson's disorder in children grown up with the stimulus?
I don't know. Not that I know of.
But you think that?
Yeah, I would think so, huh? Most of the long-term studies have only been young adults.
I've often wondered if Michael J. Fox was treated for hyperactivity. He's the kind of guy that people need to say.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also disappointed when I ask this question to neurologists, they never do a survey of previous stimulus use in their patients who do have. Seems to be an area that's simply ignored.
Was there research on amphetamine addicts who grow up? So that drug's been abused for a long time.
I have some questions.
About what?
In addicts.
Mm-hmm. So it was written that contraindicated with glaucoma, Tourette syndrome, seizures, MAO inhibitors, agitation, depression, fatigue. However, the stimulants have nonetheless been used in glaucoma, Tourette syndrome, and seizures with some success. And sometimes, I've seen in Tourette syndrome and seizures, I've seen the seizures frequency and the tic frequency reduce with the use of stimulants. So it's been inconsistent. Atomoxetine has a little bit different side effects, but abdominal pain and dyspepsia. One of the things the company has talked about is they have marketed entirely as a once-a-day preparation. Most of their clinical studies were twice-a-day dosing. And the twice-a-day dosing had much less side effects than the once-a-day dosing. And also, 6 to 8% of people are poor metabolizers, which is to say that they're it's metabolized on the 2D6 enzyme in the liver, and 6 to 8% of people, mostly Caucasians, are missing the isoenzyme, and so they don't metabolize well. They don't really have different side effects, but they have more commonly have side effects. And at the very bottom, there is some increased heart rate stimulation with atomoxetine. So then serious side effects have been discussed. And about a year and a half ago, Canada, for a while, suspended sales of Adderall because of sudden death. The FDA review quoted that there are 12 cases out of 30 million prescriptions, so less than 1 per million, but know that their surveillance is incomplete. Five of the cases had structural heart defects. The rest of them were difficult to tie to a common theme. And so there already was a recommendation not to give amphetamine to people with structural heart defects, and it was elevated to a warning. Strattera, discussion of liver injury, and two people who were taking Strattera out of 2 million developed jaundice and elevated liver enzymes. There were none of the 6,000 treated clinical trials developed elevated liver enzymes. So the two people both resolved when they removed the Strattera. One was rechallenged and it came back and removed it again and went away again. So the official recommendation is to maintain vigilance and partly a discussion. And also, if anybody sees the same thing reported to the FDA, so we can actually understand how often this really happens. There have been no subsequent reports, which doesn't mean it hasn't happened, they just haven't reported it. And then it's discussion of suicide with Strattera, reanalyzing their basic licensing data. 5 of the 1,300 children reported suicidal thoughts, and that was a box that they could check on the form. And none of the ones in placebo. No actual suicides occurred, but the discussion, again, became a warning and recommended frequent monitoring and vigilance. In the meantime, the FDA's MedWatch, which is their surveillance program for post, once they've been approved, post-marketing surveillance, has areas of interest. One of them is suicide in general. So reported an increase with Strattera and Provigil, and possibly with the stimulants. And exactly how much this happens is unknown, and whether the medicines really contribute to it or only are causal or associative is unknown. Aggression and violence, and there have been a number of reports associated with stimulants over the years, and again, little information about how much this happens. Psychosis and mania, particularly hallucinations, especially tactile hallucinations, seem to occur in children, and I'm not sure how common that is. And of course, after I saw this, I thought, you know, I've heard about this at least 2 or 3 times, but I assumed that if I heard it, everybody knew about it. I degrade myself. About children talking about a feeling of ants crawling on their arms and stuff. I didn't report it to them. And that's what the BedWet FDA knows. This stuff happens, it doesn't get reported. And again, the actual rate is unknown. Abuse potential, which is a concern about the abuse potential of stimulants. The study suggests that the detection and likability is strongly influenced by the rate of delivery. But not solely by the magnitude of plasma concentration or the transport occupancy. And so using the intravenous versus oral short-acting versus long-acting preparation. And actually do that in drug addicts who know what they're looking for. And they say that the immediate works, rapid methods work the best. Injections, smoking, snorting are the typical ones. The long-acting preparations seem much less likely to produce euphoric. Nonetheless, we have significant reports of diversion and reselling within high school and college and and beyond. Atomoxetine itself seems to have no associated euphoria. And the FDA monitors, along with the companies, monitor a number of web chat sites among illicit drug users. And every time atomoxetine comes up, it says, this was worthless, move on to something else. And so they write that down for the FDA. Yes?
Is there also a risk of abuse, though, for attentional learning issues in kids apart from trying to get euphoric effects out of it?
Yes. Yeah, that's on the very end, but okay. So then what are the long-term effects of medication? In the MTA, the multimodal treatment study, is a lot of what we know about how medicine works. So they used 6 funded sites. We are not one of them. An N of 579 children, aged 7 to 10, an intervention over 14 months. They divided into 4 groups. One group got medication alone. They used an initial titration and then monthly assessments. The second group got behavioral training, which was actually a variety of things. Parent training, in group and individual, a focused summer treatment program, similar to the one we used to do. Classroom behavior management with a teacher and individual and the daily report cards. Then there was a combined group, and then there was community care. So there's no untreated group. The medicine used was what was available at the time, primarily short-acting methylphenidate 3 times a day. Dextroamphetamine was used in 10% of the children and a few other things. And 30 children showed such a robust effect to the placebo that they were never put on medicine. So the assessments included the ADHD symptoms, aggression, social skills, internalizing symptoms, parent relations, and then academic achievement. Does that show up? Yeah, down here. Okay, it didn't show up very well. Anyway, so basically what they found were community care is X, behavior is a triangle, square is medication, and combined is a diamond. And so this is teacher reports. So teacher reports, the diamond was the best. Medication is here. This is behavior, which is improving. Now, this over the course of 14 months, we saw continued improvement. And the behavior is starting to catch up, but it still hasn't gotten there. Parent reports are showing the circle is right behind the triangle. And then that's a parent-child arguing was much better with a combined report here. And the total social skills improved here with, here's the triangle, behavior and community care. Here is the medication combined group.
Steve, so these are continued use of the medicine as opposed to use and then stopping in the medicine and see if there's continued.
Right, right. They stayed on medication the whole time.
Okay.
Yes.
Parents presumably aren't blinded to medication. Are the teachers blinded or no?
I don't remember. I think so. Although I have the report in there if you want to see. Now, the psychologists, which included Swanson again, who wrote the behavior component of it, were concerned about what does reanalyzed many sections of it, and it's still undergoing reanalyzation. And one of the things that went back to look at what were the effects, how much effect did the behavior component add, and one of them was the went back and looked at in terms of normative cutoff values and found that the combined group, 68% within the normal range, medicine 56, behavior 34, and community group was 25. And because the initial report suggested that combined was very similar to medicine, and this report suggests that combined was actually better. Another influence of the behavior group was the average medication dose was higher in the medication alone, lower in the combined group. In the community group, used an even lower dose. And one of the discussions that came out was that perhaps one of the benefits was using a higher dose of medicine. And it is common for community providers and university providers to be reluctant to push the dose up very high for fear of side effects, among other things. Parent satisfaction scores were higher with a behavioral group in combination than medicine alone and community care. And the behavior, one thing to note, the behavior interventions tapered after 9 months. So the benefit maintained to the end of the study, whereas we've seen previously that stopping the medication, all the benefit leaves with the medication leaves. But, sir?
Is there a selection bias in these groups? In other words, did parents get to choose whether they were in the behavioral or patient group?
No, they were randomly assigned.
I question that given the fact that you had some placebo patients that remained on placebo because they responded. It makes me suspect some sort of selection bias.
There was a lot of effort to not have a selection bias. So, I don't know. They tried hard not to have a selection bias. I don't know if one managed to sneak in after all. But anyway, the comment here was that while the behavioral interventions mean effect continued after the intervention stopped, whereas the medication intervention benefit stops when the medication stops. And then lastly, some children had comorbid anxiety and the behavior results approached the medication results. Now, what are the long-term effects of medication? Well, that's confusing, and basically we don't know. There is a lot that we don't know about this. It's not been well studied. Really long-term effects. One study from Rochester, Minnesota has a birth cohort study, and they follow these children through high school. Of those, 295 were treated with medication. 96% responded to either methylphenidate or dexedrine. The average time they took medication was 42 months, or about 3.5 years. Over the course of, and they were followed through high school into adulthood. There was no change in the response to medication over time and no change in the side effects noted over time. They didn't have, your question about Parkinson's and that sort of long-term side effect was not addressed. There were more side effects were seen with the amphetamine than with the methylphenidate. Biederman did a 10-year follow-up of a group that he had found previously from their clinics at Boston. And he was looking for actually psychopathology. And what he found was excess in the children who had been diagnosed with ADHD early on relative to the control group, particularly mood disorders. Reflecting how many of the children that were diagnosed with ADHD had a variant of bipolar disorder and developed mood disorders later on. Anxiety, antisocial disorders had an increased hazard ratio. And their conclusion was that, is what we have known, ADHD children were at high risk for a variety of problems in adulthood. Yes?
Starting in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
These are children diagnosed under old criteria.
Right.
And the most important thing about that is until 1994, there was no exclusion criteria in the diagnosis. That is, there was no requirement to exclude mood and anxiety disorders when making the diagnosis of ADHD. In 1994, that was added to the diagnosis criteria. However, one wonders how scrupulously that's done. In other words, how hard does a pediatrician work to exclude
This particular study was drawn, was done, the follow-up was done by the same psychiatrist who did the initial evaluation. But that is a valid question, too. That would be true for the previous study from the Rochester, Minnesota, because many of those were diagnosed by the community pediatricians.
The presence, in other words, the appearance of so much so-called comorbidity may actually be a reflection of this diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. That's not, I just remembered that they're recording this and that's not going to be picked up. So reflection of comorbidity may not be, say that again.
Well, in a study group that begins in 1976, before there's an exclusion criteria,
mm-hmm.
That results in a great deal of comorbidity in late long-term follow-up studies, that may in fact be a reflection simply of a misdiagnosis. These children may mm-hmm. in fact have had anxiety or mood disorders that were not adequately diagnosed, and they were mm-hmm. treated for an attentional disorder, right, right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I'm cognizant of at the moment is that stress affects your memory, so I'm standing up here and I can't remember anything. Barclay follow-up, so I'll tell you the hyperactive group had more failure to complete high school. Now, one of the questions has always been, they had a number of problems without reading the slide. Then one of the questions has been, what does the treatment of medication affect these? And it's been very hard to show. We know that children with ADHD have an excess number of problems of this type, that this 32% rate failure to complete high school is similar to earlier reports of untreated groups. So this is a treated group. And so many of the studies, it's difficult to compare untreated versus treatment. Most of the long-term studies don't differentiate well what the effect of treatment has been. The sum total, to me, appears that the treatment may not make a whole lot of difference, at least the use, long-term use of medication. Now, given one of the questions, is that the way we use medication now is different than the way we used it 10 years ago. And given the Rochester study, the average time was 3.5 years, and then they stopped medication. Now, in the last 5 years, the stimulants have now gotten an approval in adulthood, whereas before they were only approved up to age 16. And so now, then, there are more people who don't, that's a double negative, don't stop taking, okay, more people who continue their medication longer than they used to the time the baseline of these studies came out. So what we found, so what I understand in a long-term study is about 25% of people with ADHD continue to have significant difficulty with impulsive behavior as adults. And the adult world is not tolerant of impulsive behavior. About 50 to 60% report, or up to that much, report continued difficulty with attention. Several reports, a summary by Willen, review by Willen, suggest that there is about a twofold reduction of drug and alcohol use in adulthood from children who had been treated with stimulant medication in the past. In general, there are, as far as I'm aware, there are few to no reports of long-term serious adverse effects of medication use. So, my summary. ADHD is a heterogeneous disorder with neurobiology and environmental influences. The neurobiology shows some size and function reductions in several parts of the brain associated with dopamine transmission. Medication is a powerful symptomatic treatment, but it's not curative. It has some risks. Non-medication treatments help with and without medicine and appear to be more lasting than the medication effects. Adults may or may not accommodate to ADHD, and there's increased morbidity for those who don't. And much is known, much remains to be known. And that's my end. Thank you.